content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 14, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Our 100th year appears in the top right-hand corner of the cover as if it were a thumbprint page-turning device. Time is in large capital block lettering in a grayish color superimposed upon black, upon which is a portrait of John Fetterman. Out of the darkness, the untold story of Senator John Fetterman's battle with depression, by Molly Ball, which is the lead article which I shall read to you. John Fetterman is pictured here. A balding person with grayish facial hair. He has blue-gray eyes. He's looking askance from the camera lens, wearing some type of a grayish-white hoodie. He's neither smiling nor frowning nor grimacing, but just looking away from the camera. The first thing I'll share with you is actually a two-page photo spread. Under the heading Light Box, that's one word, Racing the Flames, the photograph is by Georgios Moutafis, Reuters. Two pages here. A man dressed in like a running or jogging suit, blue and black, wearing a white cap with the brim upturned, showing a green visor. He's leading two horses. Two bays, I would say, dark-colored with darker manes and tails. He's leading them. They're haltered with leads, but following, unhaltered, is a white, perhaps dapple gray horse. He's leading them away from a fire. A man leads horses to safety from roaring wildfires near the Greek village of Pornari, July 18. Strong, erratic winds and a recent heat wave fueled blazes throughout Greece in mid-July. Thousands evacuated the hilly countryside around Athens and islands, including Rhodes and Corfu. Fire response teams from across Europe fought the flames, which, erupting at the peak of tourist season, also produced a series of travel advisories and reports of stranded visitors. The pathway, which appears to be either graveled or a very light-colored asphalt, is clear of any flames, so the man and the horses are safe for the moment. They're walking beside what looks like a pasture, grasses, but not very well flourishing. They're not flourishing. They look very dried up to me. Behind the pasture is a rather green hill with lots of vegetation on it, and beyond that is the thick, dense gray, blue, black smoke from the flames, which one sees just licking up behind the grassy hillside. So for now, the man and the horses are safe in this July 18 photograph. Turning now to the view on the world. Nuclear Deja Vu by Mary Robinson. J. Robert Oppenheimer's shadow has stretched well into the 21st century. We're still living in the nuclear age he helped create in 1945. and still confronted with the same moral and political dilemmas he wrestled with about weapons of mass destruction. Now, Christopher Nolan's new film, Oppenheimer, offers a chance to reinvigorate public debate about the nuclear threat. Robinson, the author, is a former president of Ireland and chair of the Elders. This is a one-page article, and it features a photograph in black and white in the top right corner, so the text is not really quite a page. Black and white, vintage. A group of people, it looks like mostly men, perhaps 100% so, standing around a pile of rubble with mountains in the background. The earth here looks scorched, singed. It's just crackling. It's like pottery that's been in the oven for too long. Oppenheimer bends to inspect a melted Trinity nuclear site, July 16, 1945. In the background, there are mountains. Again, the photo's in black and white, so I can't describe to you whether there's greenery on those mountains. I'm guessing that by now there is none. A lot of these men are wearing hats, including Oppenheimer. A lot of the men are wearing suits, including Oppenheimer. A couple of military personnel are also standing in the group, and they're in uniform. Probably army khakis, but again, it's black and white. Oppenheimer was horrified by the terrible power of the technology he'd helped create. His story should sound as a wake-up call to global leaders and citizens alike, who continue to exhibit alarming complacency and fatalism about the existential risk of nuclear annihilation. Russia's war on Ukraine has heightened the threat and rendered much more difficult the prospect of meaningful U.S.-Russian dialogue on arms reduction. Its absence makes it all the more imperative that Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping put reducing nuclear risks at the top of their agenda whenever they next meet. Progress could help ease Sino-U.S. mistrust and improve wider geopolitical stability. Yet when the nuclear threat is greater than at any other time since the height of the Cold War, all leaders in all states bear responsibility. As a young woman, I marched alongside hundreds of thousands of protesters against the bomb. Now a grandmother, I am appalled that my grandchildren still face the same specter of nuclear war, and I ask myself, where are today's marchers? This is Mary Robinson referring to herself. The silence is intolerable. The hands of the doomsday clock stand at 90 seconds to midnight. The erosion of the taboo against using nuclear weapons, including from Vladimir Putin's open threats to do so, the breakdown of the remaining nuclear arms control architecture between Russia and the U.S., and the emergence of potentially destabilizing new technologies, including AI, have raised the risk level to frightening heights. China's apparent decision to significantly expand its nuclear arsenal, political instability in Pakistan, North Korea's defiance of the UN Security Council, and instability in the Middle East add further dangerous pressures. The record of close calls over the past 80 years suggests it's been more through luck than great statesmanship that we've avoided catastrophe. The only guarantee against the use of nuclear weapons is their complete abolition. Yet the world's nuclear powers continue to expand their arsenals and reaffirm the role of nuclear weapons within their security planning. The U.S. and Russia bear particular responsibility for this. They possess around 90% of the world's nuclear weapons and have dangerously undermined nuclear arms control over the past two decades. But other nuclear states, including China, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and the U.K., are also expanding their capabilities. In this context, total nuclear disarmament is not realistic in the near future. The immediate focus should therefore be on reducing the threat of nuclear catastrophe by establishing a new U.S.-China risk reduction dialogue and restarting U.S.-Russia nuclear dialogue. The Elders, the NGO that I currently lead, has proposed a nuclear minimization agenda that we believe could provide a helpful framework for making progress. It will be very difficult to tackle the nuclear threat unless there is sustained international pressure on the world's nuclear powers. That means greater public engagement and grassroots activism to challenge the questionable assumptions that underpin the thinking of the nuclear establishment. I hope the release of a major motion picture about the origins of the nuclear bomb will spur a wider debate about the issue. While there's good reason to be alarmed about current dangers, we must not despair. History shows us progress can be made to reduce nuclear risks through international cooperation, as Oppenheimer hoped. The number of nuclear weapons has declined from around 65,000 in the mid-1980s to 12,500 today. With global leadership and dialogue, further progress is still possible. In Oppenheimer's farewell address to the Association of Los Alamos Scientists in November 1945, he told them that atomic weapons are a peril which affects everyone in the world. I think that in order to handle this common problem, there must be a complete sense of community responsibility. These prescient words remain relevant. They must drive our collective efforts to contain nuclear risks if we are to prevent the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki from being repeated at a scale beyond even what Oppenheimer could have feared. The risk report by Ion Bremmer, there's still hope for Ukraine's grain and for global food markets. July 17, Russia suspended the Black Sea Grain Initiative, a deal brokered last year by the UN and Turkey that has moved some 33 million metric tons of grain and oil seeds from Ukraine to foreign ports. That deal, which Russia also briefly suspended in October 2022, provides big benefits for poorer countries struggling with high food prices. Now, Moscow claims the right to treat any foreign ship heading for a Ukrainian port as a legitimate target of war, making it impossible for outsiders to protect grain ships and pushing up shipping and insurance costs. But there are several reasons Russia's attack on Ukraine's food exports probably will not trigger an emergency for global food prices and the political turmoil that often comes with it. First, Ukraine is already sending larger amounts of food over land and by river. Data from the UN and USDA show about 47% of the country's wheat exports, 40% of its corn shipments, and 67% of exported sunflower oil reach global markets via Europe through those routes, the routes being over land and by river. Second, following a record harvest, Russia now has more wheat and grain to export. Its own Black Sea exports will continue, easing some of the upward pressure on global food prices. Despite Ukrainian threats to attack Russia shipping, its high spending on its own shipping and insurance will limit what Ukraine can afford to attempt. The USDA has also forecast big increases in corn and wheat production in coming months in Argentina, China, the EU, Turkey, and the U.S., which will help offset reduced exports from Ukraine. There are caveats here. Any fall in the global supply of agriculture products could persuade some governments to restrict their own food exports. In April and May, fears that a surge in Ukraine's overland food exports would hurt their own farmers led Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary and Slovakia to impose temporary import restrictions, urging the European Commission to let them extend those limits to at least the end of the year. The EU is now trying to help Ukrainian grain exports pass through Europe to be shipped to non-EU buyers. Finally, higher food prices risk unrest in countries heavily dependent on food supplies from the region. Egypt hopes to buy more Ukrainian grain shipped across Europe. A Kenyan foreign ministry official has called Russia's decision to suspend the deal a stab on the back, sick, in parentheses. Moscow's aware it now has real PR problems in poorer countries. But though more uncertainty in Ukraine will create risks for global food prices, all the key players are now better able to manage the fallout. The View essay, Health, Half Human, Half Robot, by Jessica Smith. Smith is a Paralympic swimmer and children's author. There's a photo of Jessica Smith at age 37 in November 2022 in Dubai. Surrounded by sand dunes, literally sand dunes, and she's standing on one, is the young woman Jessica Smith wearing a white dress with long blonde hair. She's in profile in this photo, and behind her is either a rising or a setting sun over those sand dunes in Dubai. It has a bit of a creamy, peachy orange color. On her left arm is an artificial limb in black. I was born missing my left arm, and while there really isn't anything I can do, it felt like an obvious inadequacy in a world saturated with an obsessive desire for perfection. In 1986, at 18 months, I was fitted with a prosthetic device, a decision made by my parents and doctors so I would blend in and develop normally. But there was nothing empowering about forcing a toddler to wear a heavy and at times painful device. I spent my entire childhood and adolescence trying to conform. I did just about anything to ease the agonizing pains of the stares, verbal taunts, and pointed fingers from my classmates. I wore long sleeves. I starved myself. I did whatever I needed to do to become invisible. By the time I was 8 years old, I had no self-confidence, and the hand I was wearing was making it harder and harder for me to fit in. So I decided I was better off without one. I did not need anyone to fix me, because I was not broken. One of the most obvious ways for me to prove that I was not going to be limited by my disability or physical appearance was through movement. I developed a love for all sports, in particular swimming. There was a sense of freedom and exhilaration powering through the water. I was selected to my first Australian swimming team at age 13 and successfully represented my country for 8 years, culminating in my selection to the 2004 Paralympic team. I realized I'd made a name for myself because of my disability, not in spite of it. I taught myself how to be comfortable in a society riddled with insecurities. So when I was first contacted in 2021 by Simon Pollard, whose company, COVVI, was on a mission to create the world's most advanced bionic hand, I was a bit surprised. He asked me to trial the hand and if I was comfortable with the idea to become a patient advocate. Initially, I said no. Then, curiosity got the better of me. For the past decade, I'd been observing the unwavering interest in prosthetic hands from an industry and societal perspective. While I was busy advocating for disability rights, a new generation of leaders like Amy Purdy and Nick Vujicic harnessed the power of technology and social media to show just how far we've come, posting selfies that displayed their wheelchairs, crutches, or artificial limbs without explanation. People feared disability less and were more curious. Society was beginning to see a person first and their disability second. Viewing disability through a social lens also meant acknowledging a person is more disabled by their environment and the discrimination of others than by their actual disability. As those conversations shifted, I realized there was an opportunity to use technology to steer the narrative for future generations. In July 2022, I decided to trial the hand. And while I was blown away by the technology and comfort, the process was not and is not easy. I'm still developing neural pathways, making movements for the first time that most people have embedded in their muscle memory. The role of patient advocate is an enormous privilege. Through sharing my journey, I am able to reach thousands of other people who would benefit from its extraordinary capabilities. That's why I wear a bionic hand, not because I'm broken, but because I have an opportunity to enhance the human capabilities that already exist. Now when I walk into a school, students are no longer afraid, but intrigued and excited. "That is so cool. She is half human, half robot," shouted a student on a recent school visit. The delight in his voice reassured me that working on disability inclusion is the right thing to do. And having these conversations with kids is exactly where I need to be. The View Inbox, Health Matters, by Alice Park, Senior Health Correspondent. There is no shortage of recommendations about how to become happier, but how effective are they? Well, a new study reports the most popular strategies endorsed in the media, and therefore recommended by experts, are not as supported as much by science as people may think. The analysis of thousands of happiness studies found most of them were not conducted using the most scientifically rigorous methods to evaluate the five most popular happiness strategies: expressing gratitude, practicing mindfulness, becoming more socially engaged, spending time in nature, and exercising. The biggest issue, say the scientists from the University of British Columbia who performed the review, involved adjustments researchers made from how they originally planned to analyze the data and how they actually crunched the numbers after the data were collected. "It is like throwing a dart on the wall and drawing the bullseye afterward," says Dunnigan Folk, the study's co-author. While such flexibility in interpreting data is not uncommon, widespread adjustments could alter results of studies and make them less reliable. In the psychology field, researchers are addressing the problem with online repositories where scientists pre-register their trials, which holds them accountable for sticking to the originally intended methods for analyzing data. Only a few dozen of the happiness studies were pre-registered, and those studies showed some of the strategies did indeed improve mood, but only for short periods of time. While it is likely the methods can help, having stronger, more rigorous evidence to support them could be a confidence booster. The DC Brief, by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. As the nation grappled with the first wave of COVID-19 lockdowns in March 2020, a lot of public officials were desperate for information. Everyone, it seemed, had answers, but not necessarily facts. Contradictions were as common as anxiety. So in a remarkably unsexy manner, Bloomberg Philanthropies swung into action with the network it had quietly been building with city leaders for more than a decade. By the end of that March, the database arm of billionaire Michael Bloomberg's charity operation was organizing weekly calls with mayors, public health chiefs, politicians to help thousands of officials trade information and ideas and even blow off some steam. In a moment that lacked an obvious playbook, Bloomberg Philanthropies provided a lifeline to local leaders across the country. Yet that barely scratches the surface of how this quiet giant has shaped public policy throughout the country. In the 10 years since he ended his tenure as New York City mayor, Bloomberg has become best known for his efforts promoting anti-gun violence and climate legislation. But the focus on those endeavors ignores the area where the mogul is arguably even more influential. The ninth richest man in America has emerged as the nation's mayoral tutor. Counting the newest class of mentees, including the new mayor of Los Angeles, some 275 mayors and more than 400 top aides have gone through the program at the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative in the past 6 years. Their Bloombergian government-by-data approach shows no sign of retreat. Although Bloomberg Philanthropies funds a range of programs to the tune of $1.7 billion last year alone, government efforts are probably seen every day in your cities. For instance, bike lanes have been a long priority for Bloomberg himself and thus for his charities and seminars. It is true many New Yorkers bemoan the Bloomberg era, and efforts to unspool it seem as common as mandated calorie counts on NYC menus. But there's no denying this network is quietly setting the agenda in City Hall, if you know where to look. And here's the lead story based upon the cover photo of this Time edition. The struggles of John Fetterman, that's spelled F-E-T-T-E-R-M-A-N. An unconventional senator opens up about his battle with depression by Molly Ball. And there is a photo here. It's a two-page spread of Fetterman dressed in a suit and white shirt and tie, the same bald head, with facial hair in grayish tones, white shirt, gray tie, black leather, high-top sneakers without socks that are visible. Someone is also in a dark-colored suit standing in front of Fetterman, who is seated at a table. Actually, there are two people standing in front of him holding handheld electronic devices. The caption reads, Fetterman uses an iPad to aid auditory processing issues from his stroke. And the photograph is by Shuron Huang for Time. When he looks back on the past year, a year in which he nearly died, this is under the heading Politics, it's a debate that John Fetterman identifies as the breaking point. The debate lit the match, he says, then shakes his head in frustration and tries again. The right word is there in his brain, but he struggles to get it out. Excuse me, that should be lit the match. He stops, tries again. Lit the match, he says finally. October 25, 2022, the date is lodged in his mind. I knew I had to do it, he tells me. I knew the voters deserved to have what the stroke has done to me, transparency that way. As soon as it was over, he knew it had not gone well. I knew at that moment that I was going to be consider myself like a national embarrassment, he says. Then the darkness came. The Pennsylvania Democrat sitting behind a big wooden desk in his sparsely furnished Senate office, his 6'8" frame is clad in a white hoodie, gray sweat shorts, sneakers, a sartorial signature he's maintained, despite Senate rules. For most votes, Fetterman discovered he can stand just off the Senate floor and give a thumbs up or down to the clerk, thereby avoiding having to put on a suit. Surrounding us are three iPads propped on stands, two facing him, one facing outward, that transcribe our conversation in real time, helping compensate for the auditory processing difficulties brought by his stroke just over a year ago. Fetterman has settled in to talk, through tears, about his treatment for and recovery from the severe depression that followed. In February, he checked into the neuropsychiatry unit at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center outside D.C., where he remained for more than 6 weeks. By the time he got there, he was a shell of himself, gaunt, listless, barely able to function. "I did not think I could be fixed," he says. He did not actively contemplate suicide, he tells me, but would have welcomed death if it came. If the doctor said, "Oh, by the way, you have 6 months left," I would have been like, "Okay, whatever," he says. That is how bleak it was. He considers himself lucky to have survived. Instead, Fetterman emerged transformed, he says, and has become an evangelist for the treatment he believes saved his life. This openness about a serious, ongoing mental health ordeal has put Fetterman in uncharted territory for an American politician. A half century ago, Senator Thomas Eagleton, selected as George McGovern's running mate, was dropped from the Democratic presidential ticket when it emerged he had previously been hospitalized for depression. Since then, other politicians have been more open about mental illness, but typically in the past tense. "There's been a transition in terms of stigma around these issues," says Minnesota Democrat Tina Smith, who disclosed her youthful battle with depression in a Senate floor speech in 2019. "I was talking about my experiences when I was much younger. That is very different from the leap of faith John has taken." When Fetterman set out to shatter that long-standing taboo, it was far from clear what the response would be, but he's been met, by and large, with an outpouring of goodwill from colleagues and the public alike. Senators of both parties have lauded him. People come up to him on street corners to tell him he saved their life. On a May day that I interviewed him in Washington, a suit-jacketed Republican congressional staffer carrying a Chick-fil-A takeout bag approached Fetterman to thank him for talking about his struggles. As he sat on a park bench in Philadelphia recently, a 28-year-old black woman pressed a handwritten note into his hands. "I just wanted to thank you for your bravery," it read. "I've lived with bipolar II for years. You've opened a door that has profoundly changed, sick in parentheses, the conversation in my household and community. For so many years, we've demanded our politicians be perfect, free of scandal, perfectly groomed, never a hair or a word out of place. To admit to being broken was to admit to being deficient. But Fetterman was never the kind of Paul who put much stock in seeming perfect. So he embarked on a high-stakes trust fall with the electorate of his diverse swing state, gambling they'd see him not as dangerously unstable, but as recognizably human. It turned out that many people loved their broken senator, not in spite of his brokenness, but because of it." The stroke left Fetterman's cognitive abilities intact, according to his doctors, and in hours of interviews in D.C. and Pennsylvania, the most extensive he has given since his treatment, his quick wit and grasp of policy were apparent. Though he may eventually recover full fluency with time and continued speech therapy, he sometimes struggles to express the words in his mind, but his meaning is clear. "My message is, I do not care if you are a Trumper, MAGA, or hard leftist, or anyone in between. Depression comes across the spectrum and get help with it," he tells me. It is not a Democratic senator from Pennsylvania saying this, no. I'm just a husband and a father, somebody that was suffering from depression and got help. Here his voice breaks. He wipes his eyes, takes a moment to compose himself. He's turned sideways and curled up in his chair as if trying to shrink inside himself. Before it was too late, he finally says. Before some things could have damage that can't be undone, and I would just implore anybody to get help because it can work. It worked, and I am so grateful. The people closest to Fetterman always knew there was a darkness in him. John was always a sad person, and that was okay, says his wife, Giselle Barreto Fetterman. He'd be like, I'm not too sad, you're not too happy. He was just very empathetic, I think, and he carried the pain of so many. I thought of him as melancholic. I always loved Abraham Lincoln, and historians would call him melancholy, which we later learned was really clinical depression. And I thought, oh, he's my Abraham Lincoln. It was not something I wanted to change about him. Born to working-class teenage parents in Reading, Pennsylvania, Fetterman, 53, grew up upper middle class in York after his father found success in the insurance industry. He played offensive tackle at Albright College, his dad's alma mater, then got an MBA at the University of Connecticut, planning to follow his Republican father into the family business. But when Fetterman was 24, his best friend died in a car accident, prompting a round of soul searching. He signed up for AmeriCorps, which sent him to work with low-income kids in Pittsburgh. After earning a degree from Harvard's Kennedy School, he returned to Western Pennsylvania to run a GED program in Braddock, a majority black former steel town. Braddock's population had declined precipitously. Poverty and violence were rampant. Fetterman ran for mayor in 2005 on a reform platform, beating the incumbent by a single vote in the Democratic primary. As mayor, he turned the town into a showcase for hipster urban renewal. Art studios, organic gardens, with help from a foundation funded by his father. He tattooed the local zip code 15104 on one big forearm. On the other, he inked the dates of every murder in Braddock during his tenure. Irreverent, unpretentious, progressive, the big man with the soft heart was catnip to coastal media, featured in glossy magazine profiles and on thought leader panels. He was reelected 3 times. In 2007, a formerly undocumented Brazilian immigrant, Giselle Barreto Almeida, wrote Fetterman a letter saying she admired his efforts. He invited her to visit Braddock. They fell in love and were married a year later. Fetterman made a bid for Senate in 2016, losing the Democratic primary to a conventional candidate preferred by the Democratic establishment, who went on to lose the general election. 2 years later, he defeated the incumbent lieutenant governor in the Democratic primary, earning a spot on the ticket with incumbent Governor Tom Wolf, a straight-laced former businessman. He refused the official residence that came with the job to remain in Braddock, nor was he much for ceremonial glad-handing. Pennsylvania political insiders I asked about Fetterman's tenure described him as a loner and a grump. The lieutenant governor has few official duties, but Fetterman managed to make waves. He hung gay pride and marijuana leaf flags from his office balcony, even after the legislature banned the practice. In his role overseeing the pardon board, he pushed to dramatically increase commutations and pardons. In February 2021, Fetterman announced he would again run for Senate. As 2022 dawned, he had a huge lead on his primary opponents. He was drawing big crowds and an avalanche of small-dollar donations. He would sometimes complain he did not feel well, but it never seemed serious. May 13, 2022, the Friday before the Tuesday primary election. Fetterman was in the car with Giselle, heading to a campaign event near Lancaster, when she noticed his face seemed to be drooping on one side. They drove straight to the hospital. 4 days later, Fetterman won the primary in a landslide. He spent the day of his victory anesthetized, having a pacemaker implanted in his heart. Before going under the knife, he recorded a video on his iPhone, a message to his children in case he didn't make it. From the earliest days after the stroke, doctors said a full recovery was eventually possible. Staffers and family members could detect glimpses of the old John in the way he cracked jokes and intuited the rhythms of the race. In the months when the recovery kept him off the campaign trail, he personally directed a savagely funny social media blitz depicting celebrity doctor Mehmet Oz, his Republican opponent, as an out-of-touch carpetbagger. Oz could have drawn on the soft-touch persona he had honed on the Oprah Winfrey Show to compassionately address Fetterman's health. Instead, he mocked him. If John Fetterman had ever eaten a vegetable in his life, then maybe he wouldn't have had a major stroke, a spokeswoman taunted. Later, Oz's campaign aired ads showing Fetterman struggling to speak. The Senate campaign would eventually go down as history's most expensive, a $300 million barrage of attacks that Fetterman believes exacerbated his depressive slide. Returning to the trail in August, Fetterman would ask audience members to raise their hand if they or close relatives had experienced serious health problems. "We've all been through this. I'm just doing it in the public eye," he'd say. "And I have a doctor who's making fun of me, and I hope you don't have that in your life." The strategy was a product both of necessity and of Fetterman's political persona, says Joe Calvello, his communications director. "We made a bet on empathy, that people are going to relate," Calvello says. It worked, he believes, because it was consistent with the Fetterman people knew. "His politics is about struggle," Calvello says. "As mayor, as lieutenant governor, he was all about the forgotten places, the forgotten communities, the people left behind." Yet even many who sympathized wondered whether Fetterman was up to the job. The election's lone debate loomed as the chance to prove himself. He prepared furiously. The format had never been a strength, but he did well enough in prep sessions that his camp felt optimistic. Fetterman now believes that debate will be remembered for decades as a debacle, like the time Dan Quayle couldn't spell potato or potato. His voice cracked, he stammered, he struggled to say his own name. When he managed to string words together, they were often the wrong ones. Asked to explain his support for fracking, which he'd previously opposed, he stammered, "I do support fracking, and I don't. I support fracking, and I stand. I do support fracking." The reaction was brutal. Fetterman's own polls predicted he would lose the election. 2 weeks later, he won by 5 points. Fetterman felt only numbness. Superstitious, and assuming it would take days to count votes, he had not prepared a victory speech. "We're all jumping up and down, and he's just in disbelief," his advisor Rebecca Katz recalls. "He went out and declared victory, and then we all went home, and the darkness descended." The newly elected members of Congress were invited to an orientation in D.C. the week after the election. Giselle had to force her husband to go. "Think of the insanity of that," Fetterman says. "I worked for 2 years, and at the end of that, after nearly dying, after the most infamous debate in American politics, I was going to not show up for orientation. That is what depression does." In news photographs from that event, Fetterman looks grim and uncomfortable. Surrounded by eager new lawmakers, his eyes are dim, his smile grudging. Colleagues remember wondering why he barely spoke or made eye contact. Back in Braddock, the senator would not get out of bed, not for family meals at restaurants, not for school activities for the three kids, Carl, 14, Grace, 11, and August, 9. At Thanksgiving, he came to the table for a few minutes, downed some food, went back to bed. While Giselle and the children kept up the family tradition of watching Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, at Christmas, Giselle handled Santa duty. My family was really confused, my kids especially, Fetterman says. Why, Daddy, I thought you won. Why wouldn't you be happier? What is wrong with you? And I tried to explain to them that, oh, Daddy's tired. But I could begin to sense they were blaming themselves. It still torments him, the helplessness and guilt his children must have felt. They realized something was really wrong, and they started to get more and more scared, he says. And I could not articulate to them, because I could not really articulate to myself at this point what was going on. While other newly elected lawmakers worked to get their offices up and running, aides struggled to get Fetterman to engage. At first, it seemed like he was just having a hard time getting out of campaign mode, recalls Adam Gentleson, his chief of staff. He was always talking about how Republicans would leap on every mistake. They're going to kill me with that. I kept saying, you're not running anymore. You don't have to worry about it. He became obsessed with a mini-scandal surrounding pollster Sean McAlee, who'd done work for the campaign before resigning from his firm over his gambling on elections and ties to the disgraced crypto-billionaire Sam Bankman-Fried. At freshman orientation, he was completely preoccupied with people talking behind his back, Gentleson says. I had to constantly reassure him that everything was not a crisis. The winter was dark and cold. Fetterman's D.C. apartment was in a basement. So was his temporary office suite in the Capitol. January 10, the New York Times journalist Blake Hounshell died by suicide at 44, leaving behind a wife and two young children. Fetterman had gotten to know Hounshell, a fellow stroke survivor, during the campaign. Hounshell had largely recovered from his stroke, but continued to suffer nerve pain that exacerbated the depression that had plagued him since he was a young man. The physical and psychological effects of stroke frequently contribute to depression in survivors. The news that Hounshell had taken his life hit Fetterman hard. February 8, Senate Democrats held a retreat at the Library of Congress in D.C. Fetterman sat by himself and did not talk to anybody. I was not sitting with my wife at a table next to him. I was sitting with my wife at a table next to him, and it was clear he was not having a good day, recalls Bob Casey, Pennsylvania's senior senator. I attribute it to him being a little shy, which he is. You know, he is not the most extroverted person, and he was still in the early stages of using the iPad to deal with his auditory processing issues. Fetterman stumbled out of the retreat in a fog. Fearing he was having another stroke, his staff took him to George Washington University Hospital, where he stayed two nights, receiving fluids and getting tests. The following Monday, he consulted Congress's attending physician, Brian Monahan, who diagnosed him with depression, recommended inpatient treatment, and began making arrangements for him to be admitted at Walter Reed. Finally, February 15, after pleading from staff and family members, Fetterman remembers it as an intervention. He agreed. Gentleson and another Fetterman staffer, Bobby Maggio, escorted him out of the building. I will always remember walking to his car parked a block away thinking, please don't change your mind, Gentleson recalls. He is a large man, and if he decided he did not want to go, there was going to be nothing me and Bobby could do about it. It was 5 p.m., and the car inched along in rush hour traffic. The drive took an hour. Fetterman sat silently in the back, not saying a word. For the first 2 weeks at Walter Reed, Fetterman continued to decline. He stopped shaving and showering. His normally bare head grew fuzzy. His fingernails were like claws. He did not get out of his pajamas. Seeing his face in the mirror, he did not recognize himself. He was consumed with self-loathing, convinced his own family wanted nothing to do with him. He knew he belonged in the hospital, but felt trapped there. Dr. David Williamson, director of Walter Reed's inpatient neuropsychiatry program, oversaw Fetterman's treatment. Depression to the public connotes sadness. It wasn't so much a sadness presentation, Williamson tells me. The cardinal feature of the medical illness of depression is slowed speech, movement, and a lack of drive or initiative. He was very passive, very flat, very unemotional, almost mute, although he did talk. Just a lack of responsiveness and a flatness, a lack of that spark or passion you would expect to see in humans. Williamson's team gathered records from Fetterman's doctors in D.C. and Pennsylvania and ran tests. A 360-degree review of his cardiac health, neurologic health, mental state, behavior, and daily functioning, as William puts it. They found, among other things, that Fetterman's hearing was severely diminished, exacerbating his auditory issues. He now wears hearing aids. Because he had lost so much weight, his heart medications were at too high a dosage. Cardiac tests and brain scans showed he'd not suffered any further physical damage or stroke. Fetterman gave his doctor permission to discuss his treatment with me, but declined to disclose the names and dosages of his medications. After a couple weeks of medication adjustment, Fetterman began to improve, Williamson says. His sleep got better. He began to show more emotion, regain his sense of humor. Williamson sought to educate Fetterman about his illness, to get him to see it was not mere sadness, but a medical condition rooted in brain chemistry. The senator seemed unconvinced until one weekend Williamson persuaded him to read Understanding Depression, a book by Dr. Raymond DePaulo. That's DePaulo. I came in on Monday morning and he was so animated, Williamson says. He had bookmarked and dog-eared and highlighted whole sections of that book. Giselle, it turned out, had given Fetterman the same book a decade earlier, but he had not read it. Fetterman began to venture outside into the ward's sunny courtyard, but he still refused to see his family until one day a staff therapist said something that flipped a switch. The therapist, she's like, "Hey, your wife and your kids want to come. What do you think?" And I was like, no, the kids don't want to see me. I ruined my son's birthday. I haven't been a participant in their lives for the last couple months. And the moment that changed everything was when that young therapist said, "Kids need their daddy's hugs." He chokes up at the memory of it. It was so simple, so clear, so suddenly obvious. Giselle brought the family and they picked up a packet of post-it notes that Fetterman's father had left to help him with his reading. In black ballpoint pen, they covered the neon pink, yellow, and blue stickies with pictures and messages. "We love you. Best dad ever. You will get better." Recounting this memory at the house in Braddock, Fetterman pauses our conversation and lopes back to the bedroom to retrieve the post-its. There are more than 100 of them, preserved in a wood frame. "I'm going to save these till the day I die," he says, crying. "Their visit was really kind of a pivot where I realize this is a choice. You have the support. You have the medical community. You have therapy. And this was a catalyst that helped direct me to the way forward." The final 2 weeks of his hospital stay were spent fine-tuning a treatment regimen. March 31, he left the ward and went home to Giselle and the kids. April 17, he returned to the Senate. Williamson says Fetterman's depression is now in remission. His prognosis is good, the doctor adds, provided he continues to take his medication, and he's very strongly committed to medication and treatment over the long term. The senator and his team never considered trying to hide the cause of his hospitalization at Walter Reed. We were never for a minute going to say he was being treated for exhaustion, Katz says. But they were not sure what the reaction would be when they first announced he had been admitted. As they hit send on the press release, Gentleson and Calvello recall holding their breath and exchanging a here-goes-nothing glance. They need not have worried. Lawmakers from both parties express support in public and private. Heidi and I are lifting John up in prayer. Mental health, mental illness is real and serious, tweeted Texas Republican Ted Cruz. Tina Smith, the Minnesota Democrat, brought donuts to his staff, who were soon overwhelmed with similar gifts from Republicans and Democrats alike. I'm abridging this long article, skipping to the end. In retrospect, Fetterman believes that what happened to him was inevitable, that his natural melancholy would combine with the stroke and the blowtorch of the campaign to ignite his depression. While he knows many see him as diminished or disabled, he believes what he's been through has made him stronger, wiser, more thoughtful, more appreciative. I thought I was really empathetic before, but after the stroke, then after this, I think it made me a much better senator. What he wants now, he says, is to be the voice that might have pulled him out of the darkness. Molly Ball wrote this lengthy article with reporting by Julia Zorthian. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.